Morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'm James Wexler. I'm Cummings, our president, as well.
All right.
And I appreciate your timing, to say the least.
We're glad you're here.
It was an emergency up there. And
I understand.
We did get the eviction stop, by the way. So the sheriff is enough to get out there tomorrow morning. So.
Okay, please proceed. And did you want to, you have 10 minutes. Would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, 2 minutes, please.
All right.
Thank you. Again, thank you, Your Honors, for hearing us today. We'll try to be brief, but cover the key points. One of the first points that we picked up on is in the briefing on the respondent's brief is that they claimed that the Cummings had waived by executing an agreement to waive their right to even pursue anything in exchange for allegedly a payment of $3,000. And what's not fair is they did not quote the entire letter, which I believe the court has a copy of now. If not, I have extras right here. And it literally, in the first portion of this agreement, paragraph 2, page 1, it says that if they were to initiate any action against to stop the sale, then it would void this settlement agreement or whatever it was. It's called an assistance agreement. They also never received the check or negotiated any check, and counsels never presented any evidence in any of the proceedings that they did get the check or it was negotiated, because that didn't happen. So their first argument is that somehow this was foreclosed upon.
Let me, time is short here, so let me ask you some questions. Under 6124.030.7a, that sets out requisites of a trustee sale. And one of those requisites is that there be a beneficiary or holder of the note to initiate these proceedings, correct?
Correct.
Is there any evidence in this record that Deutsche Bank is not the holder of the note?
No, they actually showed up at the trial court at the last second, literally, in the motion, and produced what they purported to be the original note.
So there's no evidence to suggest that Deutsche Bank is not the holder.
We didn't have a chance to challenge that document.
My question is there any evidence in the record to suggest that Deutsche Bank is not the holder of the note?
Well, yes. They relied on an assignment from the trust. The trust never legally held the note.
We'll get to those arguments later. Simple question. Is there any evidence to suggest that Deutsche Bank is not in possession, the holder of the note? Yes or no?
No.
Okay. There's also a well-settled principle that the security follows the note. And in this case, that would mean that the deed of trust that's associated with the note would follow it, correct?
Well, that's the act's not the whole axiom. The axiom actually.
My question is, there is well-settled law that says that. Is that not correct?
Correct. Security follows the note.
So in this case, in applying that well-settled principle, the deed of trust, which is the security in this case, would follow the promissory note, correct?
No, not in this case.
Why not?
Well, number one, the axiom actually is codified in 203 A, B, and G. And G says possession is part of the formula. But A and B are also an integral part of the entire codification of the Carpenter line of cases. It goes back 150 years. And the bottom line is you have to be an owner, because Carpenter talked about an assignment.
Brown says that ownership is irrelevant for purposes of enforcing the note. Do you disagree with what I just said?
That's what Brown says, but Brown could
Brown is the Supreme Court of the state and therefore is the final authority on the law. Is that not correct?
That's correct, but there is also a way to distinguish Brown, which we would like to explore further. Number one, they talked about, in Brown, they actually talked about negotiable instrument. Another one of our arguments is that this note is not a negotiable instrument, because under the statute, the definition of negotiable instrument, and have a copy of it for the court as well, is basically it's got to be a fixed obligation of to collect money, or a payment of money. Can't be any extraneous obligations. Paragraph 10 of the note has a clause in it concerning referencing a security agreement, which is a deed of trust. There are many other obligations in that. And there's authority now that that destroys the negotiability. If that's the case, then Article 3 doesn't apply. The person to enforce the note under Article 3 is another provision in the USCC, so the entire UCC is not applicable. Also, under the note, parties are free. That's a contract. Parties are free to contract under contract law, simple contract law, that they can have any terms they want to define things different than the UCC. And in this case, the contract defines that it says right in the beginning that parties recognize that the beneficiary, the lender, can transfer the note from time to time. But when they do that, it has to be a legal transfer. And you can't imply illegal transfers are somehow allowed. And that's what the REMIC does. It clarified REMIC because this note was in the trust outside 5 years after the trust closed in violation of the law. And they have standing to argue it these days because the Ninth Circuit came out with a case that actually said just a few months ago, and I have cited it, that basically the borrower has standing to challenge the PSA, the pooling and service agreement. And the pooling and service agreement that governed the note going into the trust that this Cummings note was in basically says New York law applies. New York law applies to almost every one of these trusts nationwide. There's millions of them. And New York law says, and the trust itself, the PSA agreement actually says that MERS is not allowed to be a conduit for any of these notes to be valid. So under the PSA agreement, it's clear that MERS voided the fact that this went into the trust, not only the fact that it's beyond the REMIC statute, but under the New York law and the PSA agreement, they're not allowed to have been involved. MERS taints the entire process of transferring note ownership and holder status because they're not allowed to have held it. And according to the Supreme Court and Bain, they're not, and Brown, they cite the same thing. You're not supposed to be, MERS is not allowed to be involved in the process. It's illegal. It voids it. So under the contract, they have a right to, as borrowers, to challenge who the parties are that are being assigned the note. Was that transfer legal? The answer, no. In this case, the trust was an illegal holder. The trust and the PSA agreement and New York law is saying that under MERS is not a proper conduit. So since the note was never legally in the trust, who's the party that Deutsche Bank got it from? They acquired nothing, basically. So Deutsche Bank had nothing. It's not even ownership.
Acquire the note or simply the deed of trust from MERS?
So the trust is that the note went into the trust. Again, if you're not an owner or legal holder of the note under the Deed of Trust Act, then you shouldn't be allowed to foreclose. The axiom says you have to be.
Could I just ask a quick question? Something in the reply brief made me think that possibly your clients, the plaintiffs, are still in the home, but I had understood that it was sold.
It was sold at the trustee sale. We had an agreement with a counsel that they would remain on the premises and not be evicted in consideration at the time of continuing a motion. And at the time, the counsel that handled it agreed.
So are they still there?
They are still there.
Thank you.
And that was by agreement.
Okay. Now, that concludes your opening.
Okay.
So you have your 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. If it pleases the Court, John Glowney on behalf of Deutsche Bank and MERS. Because two counsel are arguing, I'd like to take 6 minutes for my time and leave about four for my
time. All right. Well, you'll have until when it hits 4 minutes.
It's 4 minutes, you'll kick me out. Okay.
Yep.
I'll try to cover some of these points as briefly as I can. I think the MERS assignment is largely irrelevant to the transfer of the note. The note is a bearer instrument, therefore it's transferred by possession. It went to the trust, not through the MERS assignment, which simply gives public notice. It's not the effective agent for transferring the note. And I've cited the, the case law to that point in the briefing. The security follows the note. Carpenter is an 1872 Supreme Court case, which happened to involve an assignment. But the case law since then, for some 150 years or so, has been that whether the transfer is by negotiation, as with a promissory note that's a negotiable instrument, or by assignment, either way, the Mary's Little Lamb rule applies. The security sticks with the note. The basic principle is they don't want they treat the deed of trust as an incident of the note because you want to have the enforcement powers all in one place. So if the holder, which is the party who can enforce a negotiable instrument, has the right to enforce that, then the holder has to be able to enforce the note. Otherwise, you'd end up with the exact opposite a result that the principle is trying to accomplish, which is to keep those two things together so they can be enforced together because the deed of trust is an incident of the note. So I cited the restatement of mortgages. I didn't put any cases in specifically on that, although when I went to prepare for this, I went out and looked and found fairly quickly a couple of cases that discussed negotiation. I'd be happy to submit them if the court wanted to see them. But I would look at it this way. Since Carpenter, counsel has not submitted a single case here which said, you know, this note was negotiated and not assigned, and therefore, you know, it's split and lost the deed of trust.
Before your time expires, would you please direct some attention to the contention that New York law has anything to do with this?
And
federal law somehow impacts this analysis?
There's a history here, Judge, and I'll try to make it fairly brief. There's a New York law, the case law, looking at whether a note or whether an act in the trust is void or voidable. The case law says it's voidable. And if it's voidable, there is no standing by a borrower like this to challenge. In about 2013, there's a trial court in the New York, the Arabobo case, which said, oh, well, we think this is a void action, therefore they're standing to challenge it. Arabobo got picked up by a few cases, including the Glaske case in California. Glaske said, well, okay, if it's void, then you've got standing to challenge. The history went forward, and there's now, it's not a Ninth Circuit case, it's Yanova, it's a California Supreme Court case of February 2016, which said, well, if it's void, yes, you will have standing. In the meantime, however, Arabobo 2, the Arabobo case was overruled by the appellate court. And if you look at that case, or there's a Second Circuit case called Rajaman from about 2014, which walked through the history of this a little bit. There's other recent cases after the Ivana case in California. The history says, no, in New York, all these acts are voidable, not void. If they're voidable, as counsel, I think, admitted in his pleadings, if they're voidable, then there is no standing to challenge. So I would ask, there's a case called Yehuda versus Impact Funding Corporation, which I just looked at.
So to cut to the chase, New York law is only relevant for our consideration if it says the act's void. If it says it's voidable, we don't need to know anything more about New York law.
New York law governs the PSA in that. But New York law, as of today, is that it's avoidable. It's voidable, therefore there is no standing. Even under the Yanova case and the cases he cited in his reply brief, which was after, obviously, my response brief case.
You were about to give a citation to a funding case?
Yehuda versus Impact Funding Corporation, decided July 29th, 2016. It's a California case, 1 Cal App 5th, 1252-2016, 1 Cal App 5th, 1252. It's Yehudai. And the reason I cite to that is more that it kind of walks through this history of how what I just did in a very abbreviated.
But why would we need to even get into that? I mean, in other words, it seems to me that Washington law controls. We're talking about the Deed of Trust Foreclosure Act and the Consumer Protection Act.
You are, but the
waiver and things that have been handled quite well, it seems to me, under Washington law, and why we would want to start becoming adjuncts of either New York or the federal courts is beyond me.
I'm happy to have you not consider it, Your Honor, but he's raised it. He's mistaken in his argument on its merits. Whether or not this court thinks we should apply it or touch it on here in the state of Washington, I agree. But I'm pointing out that it's simply the law does not even state it as the way he's argued it.
I understand.
Do we need to get to this assistance agreement? at all?
You don't, Your Honor. I mean, I would argue that, yes, it may not cover acts of the trustee, and so any other claims would have been waived. So I don't know why you couldn't, but frankly, you don't need to get to it because on its merits, this was a fairly straightforward foreclosure process, and because they haven't raised any claims on their merits that apply here, in my view, you don't.
If you want to leave 4 minutes for your
I'm going
companion,
to sit down.
Now is the time.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Joshua Scher on behalf of Northwest Trustee Services. Your Honors, first there's a procedural issue with respect to my client that was passed to this panel by the Court Commissioner, and that's the fact that the appellant did not attach the ruling from the trial court to his notice of appeal with respect to Northwest Trustee. It was not designated as before this court. We went ahead and filed a response brief out of an abundance of caution to protect the trustee's interests and rebut the arguments that were raised. But
if we accept your argument, do you need to say anything further?
No. I mean, the trustee's dismissal wouldn't be properly before this court. But since I'm here, I'm happy to answer any questions that the panel may have.
Well, just be a little bit more explicit about your procedural argument is that under some rule of appellate procedure, you're saying that they did not designate the decision?
Right. The wrap, and I apologize because the number escapes me.
The long and short of your argument is that the notice of appeal describes a final summary judgment order. Your client was dismissed by an earlier summary judgment order. It isn't described in the notice of appeal, and it's not attached to it.
It was a 12B6 for us, but yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor. Exactly.
I thought I saw something in your brief about how there was an answer to the motion for reconsideration that wasn't included. Do I have that wrong? I'm trying to figure out what you're actually saying was wrong procedurally.
The notice of appeal only assigns error to the summary judgment against the loan trust and SPS.
Okay.
It doesn't provide a copy of the order dismissing Northwest Trustee Services. It was never designated as appealable. Counsel tried to appeal it by way of interlocutory review, and it was sent back because there hadn't been a final judgment with respect to the other defendants.
I see.
And then when he finally got around to doing a notice of appeal, he only appealed against the other defendants, not against Northwest Trustee.
Okay.
That's the procedural error.
Thank you.
So your position is that order is final and not subject to
any. That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. Just, I did want to touch on one issue on the merits. Judge Cox, you talked about 6124-0307. Northwest Trustee had two unambiguous beneficiary declarations, actually, two. The second one, in fact, said the note had not been assigned or transferred to any other entity. So it was very clear from the trustee perspective who the holder of the note was, and they did, in fact, comply with 030-7. There was another issue raised that Select Portfolio was not the, quote, agent of a lawful beneficiary, again, apparently arguing that the trust was not the proper authority to foreclose. That, Your Honors, was a conclusion that deserved no deference under 12b-6. This would be a legal conclusion. The use of an attorney, in fact, to execute documents on behalf of a trust is well recognized. This court recognized it in the Barclay case that I'll talk about in the next matter before you. On Monday, we had a very similar situation, a case called Bucci before a different panel where it was a loan trust and the documents were executed by Chase in the Bucci case on behalf of the trust. It's important to remember a trust is a legal entity and someone has to sign that document. And so here we have an attorney, in fact, that executed the documents, both the appointment of trustee, the beneficiary declaration, and there's no problem with that under any sort of case. And we would ask the court to hold in its opinion that there is no problem with that because, frankly, it's an issue we see coming up more and more often trying to attack the use of an attorney, in fact.
But if you are not properly before us, we need not reach
that. You would need not reach that unless you pass to the merits. And we'd ask the court to affirm, Your Honors. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wester, I believe you reserved 2 minutes.
Thank you. Well, just as a procedural matter, we did file an interim appeal of the dismissal of the trustee, and it sat for 6-7 months, and at the same time it was overlapping. We made, a presumption that because it was sitting there that they would be merged, and that seems to be a question.
That you should seek discretionary review.
Right, and it was, and it
and
was
you did not.
We did seek discretionary review. It was eventually rejected, but it was clear that we were trying to appeal their dismissal. And when he filed an answer, we read that as basically a waiver, and they had agreed to be reviewed. And he can argue it any way he wants, but the bottom line is we did file an appeal. It went to the court. The court eventually turned it back, denied discretionary review, and we ended up lumping it all together, assuming that that was filed and was in front of the court and would be held on to until the other summary judgment was held.
So you're relying apparently on some prior notice of appeal.
Correct.
Notice of discretionary
we have filed the appeal
to get the order that was not then final before us.
Correct. Announced. Correct.
And do you have any case authority for that?
Not in front of me right now, Your Honor. I can supplement the record and find one. Getting back to response, again, they keep ignoring the fact that New York law applies. It doesn't apply. Void. The Ninth Circuit just came out with the case, and it specifically found that the borrowers have standing to challenge PSA agreements. Most of them are under New York law, I think almost every one of them. So New York law is relevant to understand what you're saying. But regardless of that, the Ninth Circuit is saying for our region that the PSA agreement, in this case, it can be challenged.
Okay, thank you. We understand your argument, and you have used your time, Mr. Wexler. Thank you.